Deutsche Welle, Living Planet.
Hello and welcome to Living Planet. I'm Charlotta Lomas in Bonn. This week, controversy looms over Italy's buffalo mozzarella cheese after allegations of animal cruelty. Questions are raised over the credibility of the EU's next Commissioner for Climate Action and Energy. And cities ranked most vulnerable to climate change. All this and more here on Living Planet. Our first story takes us to the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, to a small island that has become the world's first self-sufficient island in terms of energy. The island of El Hierro, part of Spain's Canary Islands, is going 100% renewable, thanks to a mix of wind and hydropower. Lauren Freya has this report from the small island off the coast of Africa.
The irony is that it actually takes quite a lot of fossil fuel power to reach the tiny island of El Hierro, population about 10,000. Depending on where you're coming from, you need to catch at least one commercial flight, then a propeller plane or a ferry, to reach this remote outpost in the middle of the Atlantic. It's the last land Columbus saw before he set sail to discover the New World. For me, it's about a 12-hour trip from the Spanish mainland. That's the same voyage barges of diesel fuel had to make before the island's shift to renewable energy. The seabed around this active volcanic island is too volatile and the water too deep for undersea electricity lines. The only way the island got its power was by shipping in about 6,600 tons of diesel fuel by boat each year, an expensive and dirty endeavor until now. I'm standing at about 1,800 feet above sea level on a rocky mountain that's become the centerpiece of this island. Five massive metal turbines, windmills that are powering the entire island's electricity.
They are 64 meters high, so just getting them onto the island and up this mountain was a logistical nightmare. They were split into three parts that each arrived at different ports. We had to widen the road to get them through.
Engineer Juan Manuel Quintero takes me around the Garona del Viento power plant, which is gearing up to generate 100% of this island's energy needs, 48 gigawatt hours a year, all through renewable wind and water energy. Wind turbines harness the Canaries' Atlantic gusts. When production exceeds demand, like at night, excess energy is used to pump water from a sea level tank up into a natural crater half a mile uphill on El Hierro's volcano. When the wind dies down, the water is released into a turbine to generate more power. Quintero explains.
La central eólica se compone de cinco aerogeneradores, que es la que genera la energía.
The plant consists of five windmills and two lakes, one on top of the mountain and one below, connected with a big tube. So when there's enough wind, we use the windmills to power the island and to pump water from the bottom lake up to the top one. Then if the wind dies down, that water is released down through turbines, hydroelectric power.
Everything's connected with sensors so that within 5 seconds of the wind dying down, the hydro part of the plant kicks in. For residents, the lights don't even flicker. Juan Manuel drives me from the hilltop windmills down to the lower lake and water turbine. So we're standing here next to this pretty big lake at the bottom of the mountain, and it's almost empty.
Exacto. La consigna siempre es que el depósito inferior...
Exactly. When this lake is empty, it means we've got potential power above, waiting for a weak wind day to release the water.
Esa energía en la parte superior y utilizarla cuando no tengamos viento suficiente.
It's so simple and yet nobody did it before.
No, yo creo que no sé, lo hemos hecho por separado, pero
no, it's been done separately, but no one's ever combined water and wind. It's simple. The wind machines we basically ordered out of catalog. We didn't invent the technology. Same with the wind turbines. The innovation we made is hooking up the two systems together.
Y después una central de bombeo que también es igual.
The Spanish government, a local university, and a Spanish power company helped with a total investment of about 90 million euros.
So we are lucky the crisis came when the project was almost finished.
Island Governor Elpidio Armas says this was one of the last projects Spain approved before the economic crisis prompted the government to cut all of its subsidies for renewable energy 2 years ago. El Hierro has long been known as a place people left behind, a windy, harsh outpost more than 1,000 kilometers off mainland Europe, out in the Atlantic. Now the governor hopes this new power station could bring people back and make them proud of their island.
When they turn on the light, they think of the windmills moving, and maybe they think we are different from the rest of the world because we are getting electricity from the windmills and not for the conventional engines.
¿Y qué piensan en este corona del viento? ¿Es algo malo? ¿Es algo bueno?
No, es algo, una buena inversión.
Most residents I met shrugged and said they're fine with the power plant, though it doesn't lower their electricity bills. Prices for power are still set at a national level. But by cutting diesel deliveries, the Spanish government saves nearly 2 million euros a year, even after factoring in costs to build and maintain the 90 million euro power plant. Energy economist Gonzalo Escribano at Madrid's Elcano Royal Institute says the new power scheme has given this isolated community energy security, perhaps forever.
How much will be the price for oil in 20 years' time? We don't know. But we are sure that we will still have wind in the Canary Island in El Hierro in 20 years' time. And the price or the cost to generate an additional gigawatt will be zero. Just very small costs regarding maintenance and so on and so forth.
El Hierro has halted consumption of 40,000 barrels of oil each year. That's more than 20,000 tons of CO2 that are not being released into the atmosphere here. But El Hierro won't leave it at that. Its governor is looking ahead to having all of the island's cars be electric by the year 2020. Lauren Freyer, DW, on El Hierro in Spain's Canary Islands.
Next, we go to Italy, a country famous for its buffalo mozzarella cheese. The cheese, however, has caused quite a stink recently. The international animal rights organisation Four Paws posted a video showing the shocking conditions on buffalo farms that produce the milk for mozzarella cheese. But the organisation, which represents buffalo farms and mozzarella producers, says the video isn't representative of the whole industry. Angelo van Schaik has this report from Caserta.
In the last 2 years, Four Paws has visited over a dozen buffalo farms in the Italian region of Campania. The reality bites. Business as usual.
This is the video that has shocked animal lovers and fans of mozzarella around the world. Images of buffaloes with open wounds living in very small pens full of their own excrement. Footage of cows being killed by a hammer blow because they don't produce milk, and therefore are considered useless. Animals which are thirsty because there's not enough water for them. Cesare Yemma owns one of the biggest buffalo farms in Pastorano, a small village 50 kilometers north of Naples. He has 1,800 animals and produces his own mozzarella on site. He shrugs his shoulders as he watches the video.
Io penso che in qualsiasi paese, in qualsiasi filiera, sia sulle vacche, sia sulle...
I think that in every sector, whether it's cows or buffaloes, there are people that work in one way and people that work in another. But this is not my reality.
Yemma shows me around on his farm. 200 hectares with 13 stables and 4 large meadows containing pools of water. Yes, Yemma's buffaloes have their own swimming pool.
Fondamentalmente, in questa azienda, alle 10:30, tutti gli animali, dopo la mungitura, tutti gli animali da latte hanno la possibilità.
After the morning milking session at around 10 a.m, all the animals on this farm have the chance to go outside to the meadows and have a bath.
We change the water frequently. After the afternoon milking, the animals have to stay inside the stables, but in the mornings they can wander around freely.
Yemma's farm is in the province of Caserta. 50% of all mozzarella di bufala comes from here. In total, there are around 600 mozzarella cheese factories and buffalo farms. And it's a 500 million euro business. But only half of these companies belong to the Consorzio Mozzarella di Bufala Campana DOP. That's an EU-registered organization that controls the quality of the cheese and the buffalo farms. Strict rules apply for members of the consortium, including rules relating to animal welfare, according to Antonio Lucisano, director of the consortium. He's also seen the video produced by the animal rights organization Four Paws.
È una reazione di rabbia profondissima, perché vorrei davvero sapere chi è questo personaggio, chi sono questi personaggi per poterli perseguire, perché a parte il danno economico che...
My first reaction was one of profound anger. I really want to know who these people are, to be able to take legal steps against them. Apart from the economic damage they inflict, these people are destroying the hard work of a lot of honest people. I can assure you that the vast majority of the thousands of people working in the sector get up early every day, 365 days a year, to produce mozzarella di bufala.
The trauma of the buffalo starts right after birth.
The whole problem is that businesses that are not members of the consortium can legally produce mozzarella di bufala by using a slightly different name, something that is impossible with Parmigiano Reggiano, that other world-famous Italian cheese. Furthermore, Caserta is not only the capital of buffalo mozzarella, but also of the Camorra, a violent mafia organization which is also involved in producing mozzarella. That's also not very good for the image of the cheese. Antonio Lucisano again.
Certamente è un vulnus, è una ferita, è un motivo di grande preoccupazione.
It's a wound. It really makes me feel bad. Of course, we could use it as an opportunity to improve, just like we did with the dioxin problems and with the garbage crisis which dogged this area a few years ago. The reason we have an ethics code is because we faced problems in the past. I'll give you an example of what we're doing. At our next meeting, we have scheduled a discussion on animal welfare. Up until now, I have to admit, we didn't have any real regulation for that on our statute books, other than the ones that are controlled by EU rules.
The Mozzarella Consortium doesn't deny there are problems in the sector, but stands by the cheese produced by its members, who are subjected to around 200 checks a year. The organisation says it has never encountered any problems, but it's calling for stricter rules on what cheese can call itself mozzarella di bufala. That in turn will protect buffaloes, as well as businesses and consumers. Angelo von Schaik, DW, Caserta, Italy.
Cyclones, hurricanes, floods, droughts, countries around the world are battling with climate-related weather events. This week, the United Nations University, or UNU, released its annual World Risk Report, which tallies the countries according to their vulnerability to extreme weather and climate change. Earlier, I spoke to Professor Jorn Berkman, the UNU's head of environment and human security. So which countries does the 2014 report indicate are the most at risk, and what are the reasons for this?
In the 2014 edition, we tried to look at risk at a national scale resolution and risk in urban areas, because often urban areas are seen as the risk hotspots. For the World Risk Index at the national scale resolution, it's particularly Vanuatu, the Philippines, Tonga and Guatemala and Bangladesh who rank highest in our risk score, particularly due to a high exposure to natural phenomena like for Vanuatu, sea level rise, for the Philippines, cyclones, etc., and a high social and societal vulnerability. The urban cluster is a bit different. Here it was somehow for us surprising that Costa Rica, the Philippines and Chile are, for example, the countries with the highest score. In terms of the urban risk, we were surprised that, for example, the level of urbanization, so how many people are living in cities, is actually not so important as the question how fast cities are growing. So in a lot of countries where actually the urbanization level is rather low, but at the same time you find a lot of rapidly growing cities there, the vulnerability of urban areas is very high.
Why is that? Why does fast urbanization increase the risk of exposure to natural disasters and climate change?
We have a lot of cities or urban areas which are exposed to different extreme events or creeping hazards like sea level rise. Australia, United States are ranked among those who are highly exposed. However, in these urban areas, the degree of preparation for extreme events, early warning systems, insurance coverage, social protection regimes, income structures are still quite good compared, for example, to countries where you have a low urbanization rate, but at the same time, these cities are growing rapidly, and therefore, for example, you have a lot of informal settlements. The infrastructure provision can't meet the demands. We could take Nigeria and Lagos, a large city in Africa, and here the actual resources of the country and of the city do not meet the demands. For example, access to health infrastructures, access to sanitation and piped water, or in governance indicators. And we are seeing, for example, with the phenomenon of Ebola, that also these kind of crises and hazards cannot be sufficiently managed and coped with. And this gives us an indication that not only the exposure to an extreme event is important, but also the capacities of a society and of an urban society to deal with it.
What are the main contributing factors you consider to determine how at risk a city is to climate change and natural disasters?
We are asking how does the urban area compare to the rural area actually is exposed to extreme events. And many cities actually around the world are lying in low-lying coastal areas or on in floodplains because there were connections in former times. And there are definitely benefits also for cities in coastal areas in terms of trade connections. On the other hand, we're trying to compare not only the exposure, so the physical exposure to natural phenomena, but we also want to know what are the resources of people living in these cities to actually cope and adapt to these environmental hazards and extreme events. So is there sufficient capital? Are people sufficiently educated to actually develop preventive measures and adaptation measures?
How can governments reduce the risks of climate change and natural disasters?
I think our index really shows that it's important to look at the broader picture. So what we have often seen is that governments are responding to these extreme events as something which comes from outside. So you need better early warning system, you need a better detection of hazards, of cyclones, etc. This is all needed, but I think our index clearly shows through the analysis of the vulnerability of people that you have to also invest how people can prepare themselves for these extreme events, for example, insurance regimes, social protection, access to education, access to basic infrastructure, improvement of slum areas.
But how do we address that if these countries don't have much money?
There are huge funds actually to fund countries' activities for adaptation. And here I think we should be broader. We should not just finance weather radars, but we might need to finance also social protection regimes and should support maybe regional and local initiatives for a better governance structure and development process.
Professor Jan Berkman there from the United Nations University. Conflicts of interest, ideological mutinies and late-night backroom deals hatched by power brokers. Environmental politics in the European Union has never been this dramatic. At the centre of the controversy is Spanish politician Miguel Arias-Cañete, who's just been confirmed as the EU's next Commissioner for Climate Action and Energy. Throughout a long political career, Cañete has been dogged by claims of conflicts of interest over his family's investments. But it's the Commissioner's close relationship with the oil industry which led to a clash on the floor of the European Parliament. James Paniki has the details from Brussels.
Today, Natura 2000 is the largest network of protected areas in the world.
That is what EU environmental policy sounds like once it has made its way through an often unseemly process of compromise and political horse trading. But last week, EU environmental policy was sounding a lot less glossy.
Commissioner designate, although you have recently sold your shares in oil companies, nonetheless you chaired those companies, built a network and created strong connections with the oil industry. In light of this, how do you intend to be objective about your role in the oil industry?
That was Theresa Griffin, a British Labour member of the European Parliament with the centre-left Socialist and Democrats political grouping, the S&D. The heckles were coming from members of parliament from the centre-right European People's Party, and their anger was palpable. They sensed that Cañete's parliamentary hearing had become a free-for-all. The SND's vigorous questioning, along with that of Green members of Parliament's Environment Committee, left Cañete shaking and flustered as he fought for his political survival. He repeatedly defended his family's investments in the oil industry, saying that they in no way affected his decisions as a Spanish minister.
I was writing letters to the commissioners in order that they went in the 230 package for very ambitious climate objectives. I was not supporting oil. I was supporting renewables, energy efficiency. I've never been linked to the oil. I had 2% in a company. But when I had public responsibilities, I was standing with the people who work for green growth, for renewables, for energy efficiency, and for fighting climate change. That's what I did in the past, and that's what I will do in the future.
Yet the S&D members appeared to be after Cañete's scalp, and they didn't relent. Kathleen van Bremt is an S&D member from Belgium. She honed in on Cañete's recent moves to rid himself of shares in two oil companies.
I have some very specific question, if you could answer just with yes and no. Can you confirm that your son, up until a few days, was member of the board of directors in both companies? Can you confirm that your brother-in-law replaced you as chairman in both companies? And is it true that the second and third largest shareholders of Petrofilera are two companies, both founded by yourself and your wife, are now in the hands of your brother-in-law?
The European Parliament can use the hearings of commissioners designate to reject candidates which it considers unfit. It has done that before. In fact, it had only just rejected Slovenia's commissioner after an excruciating hearing. However, according to media reports in Brussels, S&D leaders had already committed to allowing Cañete's appointment to sail through. In return, the European People's Party would support France's ailing centre-left candidate, Pierre Moscovici. The decision to pursue Cañete on the part of S&D members threw that deal into disarray, prompting power brokers from both sides to hit the phones. By the following day, S&D leader Gianni Pittella was triumphant as he faced the press.
La competenza sullo sviluppo sostenibile, che ha un doppio...
Pittella revealed he had received a letter from no less than the incoming Commission President, Jean-Claude Juncker. In it, Juncker apparently promised that Cañete would not be allowed to sign off on sustainable development bills. The oversight of that policy area would be taken on by Commission Vice President Frans Timmermans, a Dutchman from the centre-left. Magda Stojkevic is the director of Friends of the Earth Europe, an environmental NGO.
We are definitely happy with the fact that Vice President Timmermans has now apparently sustainability in his mandate. That's something that environmental NGOs have been fighting for, because the whole setup of the Commission was completely neglecting the environment and sustainability.
Although Stojkevic says that placing the portfolio under the supervision of another commissioner does not solve what she sees as Cañete's conflict of interest.
These issues are deep-rooted. If you look at the history of Mr. Cañete's political and personal deeds, you can see that for the last 20 years or more, there were issues of alleged conflict of interest all along his career. So why should we believe that now suddenly everything is going to be fine?
Indeed, conflict of interest concerns go deep into Cañete's CV. As a member of the Spanish Parliament in 1996, he asked questions about the car repair market, while failing to declare that he was a board member of a car company. In 2001, he neglected to reveal his investments in gambling companies and an agricultural holding company, and the list goes on.
Hi, I'm James. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
Buzz Eickhout is a Green MEP from Holland and is a member of the committee which grilled the future commissioner. He said the hearings were not able to get to the bottom of Cañete's business dealings.
And that's why I'm so disappointed in S&D, that they are accepting this commissioner because of all kind of political power play, and we're not discussing the contents anymore, and that's very disappointing.
Putting aside the conflict of interest, though, was there anything to suggest that he would not have been an appropriate commissioner for this portfolio?
I think for me, if you look at the contents, you know, the competence on the issues, It was clear that Mr. Cañete knows what he's talking about. So, we as a parliament have to judge a commissioner on several issues. On competence, he did well. On relations with the parliament, he did well. But whether he's beyond any reasonable doubt, there clearly he failed. And if he fails on that, then he fails as a commissioner designate, to my sense. But clearly some others think differently.
Indeed, Cañete's appointment as commissioner was eventually confirmed after SND leader Pittella read his members the Riot Act at a party room meeting. The compromise deal to downgrade Cañete's authority over sustainable development policy was not enough to appease all SND parliamentarians. However, the controversy has guaranteed that all future EU sustainable development legislation and the political machinations behind it will face a much higher level of public scrutiny. In Brussels, this is James Panichi for DW.
Now, you've probably heard about horse whisperers or dog and cat therapists, but have you ever heard of a whale crier before? You probably have if you've read the book Moby Dick. Well, there's a real-life whale crier in the small city of Hermanus in South Africa, one of the best spots for whale watching in the world. And it's the only place in the world that has someone who helps you spot the whales, a whale crier. Nina Bart met up with a whale crier and Sarah Steffen presents her report.
There it is, the sound that everyone has been waiting for. It's the sound Eric, better known as the whale crier, makes when he blows his horn. It's a signal that whales are in sight. Eric is the only whale crier in the world. He's walking along the cliffs of Hermanus, a small South African town about 120 kilometers away from Cape Town, with his long black curved horn in hand. Whales come to the Bay of Hermanus between the months of July and November. And once they show up, Eric knows exactly how to spot them.
Just take your eyes a little bit further down. Look at there. Look at the fin is out of the water now. I think it's plus minus 400 meters away from us. It looks like there is a group of them there. And if you look on your left-hand side, there is a little baby breaching. Today it looks like it's going to be a best day for us in Hermanus.
Thanks to Eric, everyone can now see the magnificent animals.
Look here. Yeah, there it is. Oh, it's wonderful. Wonderful.
It warms my heart. I get quite emotional.
Beautiful. This is an amazing experience.
It's just so incredible.
Today, the whales are so close to the coast that you can even hear the deep sound they make. It's a moment that makes whale crier Eric happy.
This is their home, I must say. Although there is nothing for them to eat, they only come down here for mating and giving birth. So, for me, it feels like they know that they are protected and they are safe enough to do what they came to do in this bay.
Eric loves these giant animals, which can get up to 16 meters long. 3 years ago, when Eric was still working as a parking attendant, he applied for the position as whale crier and got it. Now, this man in his mid-20s has become a tourist attraction himself.
Last week, there was a lady who came down here. She said she didn't see any whale. But she was not looking for the whale, she was looking for the whale crier. I think people like what Hermanus has decided to have in this place, because Hermanus is the only one place that has the whale crier.
When Eric walks along the cliffs of the small town of Hermanus, his whale crier sign on his back and his horn made from seaweed dangling around his neck, people can't help but stop and smile.
It's fabulous.
It's so cool.
A nice one. You're so friendly. Cool.
He says he can't even count the many times tourists have asked him whether they can take a picture of him. But he doesn't mind. It's all part of the job. And it's this job, he says, that changed his life.
For me to be the one and only whale crier in the world, it changed my life. It makes my life feel like I'm an ambassador of this town. I feel so excited to work with these mammals in the bay.
And then he blows his horn again. Today really is the perfect day for whale watching.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Living Planet. You can download episodes or replay them online at dw.de/environment. You can also find us on SoundCloud and iTunes. Living Planet is produced and presented by me, Charlotte Lomas. Our studio director was Iliane Ghilarducci and our studio technician was Claudia Rack. Tune in next week for more news and stories about the environment. Until then, thanks for listening.